I get from Oath's contain three shots, whereas this coffee is unusually weak, probably due to your lack of experience. Well, you know who's making it next time. Rosie was smiling. It seemed like a good time to introduce the additional arguments in favour of Jean, but Rosie spoke first.
Don, about Jean. I know he's your friend. I get that you're just being loyal and kind, and maybe if I hadn't just discovered I was pregnant. But I'm only going to say this once, and we can get on with our lives. We do not have space for Jean. End of story.
I mentally filed the end-of-story formula as a useful technique for terminating a conversation, but Rosie contradicted it within seconds as I swung my feet out of the bed. Hey, you. I've got writing to do today, but I'm going to kick your ass tonight. Give me a hug. She pulled me back to the bed and kissed me. It defies belief that a person's emotional state could be deduced from such an inconsistent set of messages. In reviewing my interaction with Rosie, I concluded that her reference to kicking my ass was metaphorical and should be interpreted positively. We had established a practice of attempting to outperform each other at The Alchemist. In general, I consider the artificial addition of competition to professional activities to be counterproductive, but our efficiency had shown a steady improvement. Time at the cocktail bar appeared to pass quickly, a reliable indication that we were enjoying ourselves. Unfortunately, there had been a change of ownership. Any alteration to an optimum situation can only be negative, and the new manager, whose name was Hector, but whom we referred to privately as Wineman, was demonstrating this. Wineman was approximately 28 years old, estimated BMI 22, with a black goatee and heavy-framed glasses in the style that had once marked me as a nerd but was now fashionable. He had replaced the small tables with longer benches, increased the intensity of the lighting, and shifted the drink's focus from cocktails to Spanish wine to complement the revised menu, which consisted of paella. Wineman had recently completed a Master of Business Administration, and I assumed his changes were in line with best practice in the hospitality industry. However, the net effect had been a fall in patronage and the consequent firing of two of our colleagues, which he attributed to difficult economic conditions. "They brought me in just in time," he said frequently. Rosie and I held hands on the walking component of the journey to the Flatiron neighborhood. She seemed to be in an excellent mood, despite her ritual objection to the black and white uniform that I, personally, found highly attractive. We arrived 2 minutes ahead of schedule at 7:28 p.m. Only three tables were occupied. There was no one sitting at the bar. "You're cutting it fine," said Wineman. "Punctuality is one of your performance measures." Rosie looked around the sparsely populated room. "Doesn't look like you're under any pressure." "That's about to change," said Wineman. "We got a booking for 16 at 8.
"I thought we didn't take bookings," I said. "I thought that was a new rule."
"The new rule is that we take money, and they're VIPs, VVIPs, friends of mine." It was a further 22 minutes before anyone ordered cocktails due to absence of clientele. A party of four, estimated ages mid-40s, estimated BMIs between 20 and 28, arrived and sat at the bar, despite Wineman attempting to direct them to a table.
"What can I get you?" asked Rosie.
The two men and two women exchanged glances. It was extraordinary that people needed the advice of their friends and colleagues to make such a routine decision. If they insisted on external counsel, however, it was best that it came from a professional. "I recommend cocktails," I said. "As this is a cocktail bar, we can accommodate all known taste and alcohol requirements." Wineman had taken up a position to my left on the client side of the bar. "Don can also show you our new wine list," he said. Rosie put a closed copy of the leather-bound document on the bar top. The group ignored it. One of the men smiled. "Cocktails sound good to me. I'll have a whiskey sour." "With or without egg white?" I asked, in line with my responsibility for order negotiation.
"With."
"Straight or over ice?"
"On the rocks."
"Excellent." I called to Rosie.
"One Boston sour over ice."
Slapped my hand on the bar and started the timer on my watch. Rosie was already standing at the liquor shelves behind me, and I knew that she would be sourcing the whiskey. I put a shaker on the bar, added a scoop of ice and halved a lemon as I solicited and clarified the remaining three orders. I was conscious of Wineman watching. I hoped that, as a business administration graduate, he would be impressed. The process I had designed and refined makes best use of our respective capabilities. I have the superior database of recipes, but Rosie's dexterity level is higher than mine. There are economies of scale in one person squeezing the total lemon juice requirement or performing all of the pours of a particular liquor. Of course, such opportunities need to be identified in real time, which necessitates an agile mind and some practice. I considered it highly unlikely that two bartenders working on individual cocktails could perform as well. As I poured the third cocktail, a cosmopolitan, Rosie was tapping her fingers, having already garnished the mojito. She had kicked my ass, at least in the first round. As we served the cocktails with the simultaneous movement of our forearms, our clients laughed, then applauded. We were accustomed to this response. Wineman was also smiling. "Take a table," he said to our customers. "We're fine here," said Boston Sour Man. He sipped his drink, enjoying the show, the best whiskey sour I ever had. "Please sit down, I'll order some tapas on the house." Wineman took four glasses from the rack. "Did you see Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom?" he said. I shook my head. "Well, Don, you and Rosie just reminded me of the scene where Mr. Jones's assailant shows off his skills with a sword." Wyman pointed to our clients drinking their cocktails and made some moves that were presumably meant to simulate swordsmanship. "Whoosh, whoosh, whoosh, whoosh. Very impressive. Four cocktails, $72. Wyman picked up an open bottle of red wine. "Florida Pingu." He poured four glasses and made a sign with his hand, holding his index finger and thumb at 90 degrees, with his remaining fingers folded. "Bang, bang, 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 $192. "Jerk," said Rosie as Wyman delivered the drinks to a group of four who had arrived during our cocktail making. This time her tone was not affectionate. "Check out their faces. They look happy. Wyman's argument is valid." "Of course they're happy. They hadn't ordered anything yet. Everyone's happy when the drinks are on the house." Rosie put a highball glass in the rack with unnecessary force. I detected anger. "I recommend going home," I said. "What? I'm okay. Just pissed off. Not with you." "Correct," stressed, creating cortisol, which is unhealthy for Bud. "Based on experience, there is a high probability that you will initiate an unpleasant interaction with Wineman and be stressed for the remainder of the shift. Restraining yourself will also be stressful." "You know me too well. Can you cope without me?" "Of course. Numbers are low." "That's not what I meant." She laughed and kissed me. "I'll tell Wineman I'm feeling sick." At 9:34 p.m., a group of 18 arrived, and the table that had remained reserved and unused for the entire evening was extended to accommodate them. Several were noticeably intoxicated. One woman, aged in her mid-20s, was the focus of attention. I automatically estimated her BMI 26. Based on the volume and tone of her speech, I calculated her blood alcohol level at 0.1 grams per liter. "She's shorter in real life and a bit porkier," Jamie Paul, our bartending colleague, was looking at the group.
"Who?
Who do you think?" He pointed to Loud Woman.
"Who's she?"
"You're kidding me, right?" I was not kidding, but Jamie Paul offered no further explanation. A few minutes later, with the party seated, Wyman approached me.
"They want the cocktail geek. I'm guessing that's you."
I walked to the table where I was greeted by a male with red hair, though not as dramatically red as Rosie's. The group appeared to be made up entirely of people in their mid to late 20s.
"You're the cocktail guy."
"Correct. I am employed to make cocktails. What would you like?"
"You're the guy with, like, a cocktail for every occasion, right? And you keep all the orders in your head. You're that guy?"
"There may be others with the same skills." He addressed the rest of the table loudly as the ambient noise was now significant.
"Okay, this guy. What's your name?"
"Don Tillman."
"Hello, Dan," said Loud Woman. "What do you do when you're not making cocktails?"
"Numerous activities. I'm employed as a professor of genetics." Loud Woman laughed again, even more loudly. Redhair continued.
"Okay, Don is the king of cocktails. He's memorized every cocktail on the planet, and all you need to say is bourbon and vermouth, and he'll say martini.
Manhattan, or an American in Paris, Boulevardier, Oppenheim, American sweetheart, or man of war." Loud Woman laughed loudly.
"He's Rain Man, you know, Dustin Hoffman when he remembers all the cards. Dan's the cocktail Rain Man."
Rain Man. I had seen the film. I did not identify in any way with Rain Man, who was inarticulate, dependent, and unemployable. A society of Rain Man would be dysfunctional. A society of Don Tillman's would be efficient, safe, and pleasant for all of us. A few members of the group laughed, but I decided to ignore the comment as I'd ignored the error with my name. Loud Woman was intoxicated and would likely be embarrassed if she saw a video of herself later. Red Hair continued.
Don's going to pick a cocktail to fit whatever you want. Then he's going to memorize everybody's orders and come back and give them to the right people, right, Don?
As long as people don't change seats. My memory does not handle faces as well as numbers. I looked at Red Hair.
Do you wish to commence the process?
Got anything with tequila and bourbon?
I recommend a Highland Margarita. The name implies Scotch whiskey, but the use of bourbon is a documented option.
Okay, said Red Hair, as though I'd hit a home run to win the game in the bottom of the ninth inning.
I was 1/18 of the way to completing my task. I refocused on the drinks orders rather than on constructing a more detailed baseball analogy around this interesting number. They could wait until my next meeting with Dave.
Red Hair's neighbor wanted something like a margarita, but more like a long drink, but not just a margarita on the rocks or a margarita with soda, but something, you know, different, like to make it more unique. I recommended a Paloma made with pink grapefruit juice and rimmed with smoked salt. Now it was Loud Woman's turn. I looked carefully, but did not recognize her. This was not inconsistent with her being famous. I had largely ignored popular culture. Even if she'd been a leading geneticist, I would not have expected to know her face.
Okay, Rain Man Dan, make me a cocktail that expresses my personality.
This suggestion was met with loud sounds of approval. Unfortunately, I was in no position to meet the requirement. I'm sorry, I don't know anything about you.
You're kidding me, right?
Wrong. I tried to think of some way of asking politely about her personality. What is your occupation? There was laughter from everyone except Loud Woman, who seemed to be considering her answer.
I can do that. I'm an actor and a singer, and I'll tell you something else. Everybody thinks they know me, but nobody truly does. Now, what's my cocktail, Rayman Dan? The mysterious Chanteuse, maybe?
I was unfamiliar with any cocktail of that name, which probably meant she had invented it to impress her friends. My brain is highly efficient at cocktail searching based on ingredients, but it is also good at finding unusual patterns. The two occupations and the personal description combine to produce a match without conscious effort. A two-faced cheater. I was about to announce my solution when I realized that there might be a problem. One that placed me in danger of violating my legal and moral duty as the holder of a New York State Liquor Authority Alcohol Training Awareness Program certificate. I took remedial action.
I recommend a virgin colada.
What's that supposed to mean, that I'm a virgin?
Definitely not. Everybody laughed. I elaborated. It's like a pina colada, but non-alcoholic.
Non-alcoholic? What's that supposed to mean?
The conversation was becoming unnecessarily complicated. It was easiest to get to the point. Are you pregnant?
What?
Pregnant women should not drink alcohol. If you're only overweight, I can serve you an alcoholic cocktail, but I require clarification. As I rode the subway home at 9:52 p.m., I reflected on whether my judgment had been affected by the Rosie situation. I'd never suspected a client of being pregnant before. Perhaps she was merely overweight. Should I have interfered with a stranger's decision to drink alcohol in a country that valued individual autonomy and responsibility so highly? I made a mental list of the problems that had accumulated in the past 52 hours and which now required urgent resolution. 1. Modification of my schedule to accommodate twice daily beer inspections. 2. The Jean accommodation problem. 3. The Jerome laundry problem, which had now escalated. 4. The threat of eviction due to 3. 5. Accommodating a baby in our small apartment. 6. Paying our rent and other bills now that Rosie and I had both lost our part-time jobs as a result of my actions. 7. How to reveal 6 to Rosie without causing stress and associated toxic effects of cortisol. 8. Risk of recurrence of the meltdown and fatal damage to my relationship with Rosie as a result of all of the above. Problem solving requires time, but time was limited. The beer was due to arrive within 24 hours. The superintendent would probably accost me by tomorrow evening, and Jerome could attempt an act of revenge at any time. Jean was about to arrive, and Bud was only 35 weeks away. What I required was a means of cutting the Gordian knot, a single action that would solve most or all of the problems at once. I arrived home to find Rosie asleep and decided to consume some alcohol to encourage creative thinking. As I reshuffled the contents of the fridge to access the beer, the answer came to me. The fridge. We would get a bigger fridge, and all other problems would be solved. I phoned George. Chapter 6. It is generally accepted that people enjoy surprises, hence the traditions associated with Christmas, birthdays, and anniversaries. In my experience, most of the pleasure accrues to the giver. The victim is frequently under pressure to feign, at short notice, a positive response to an unwanted object or unscheduled event. Rosie insisted on observing the gift-giving traditions, but she had been remarkably perceptive in her choices. Colleagues had already commented positively on the shoes that Rosie had given me for my 41st birthday 10 days earlier, and which I now wore to work in place of expired running shoes. Rosie claimed to enjoy surprises, to the extent of saying, "Surprise me," when I sought her advice on which play or concert or restaurant to book. Now I was planning a surprise that would exceed all previous instances. With the exception of the revelation of her biological father's identity and the offer of an engagement ring. It is considered acceptable to engage in temporary deception in support of a surprise. "You coming, Don?" said Rosie as she departed the following morning. Although Rosie was technically on vacation, she was continuing to work on her thesis at Columbia on weekdays, as the apartment gave her cabin fever. She was wearing a short dress with blue spots that I suspected was a recent purchase. The belt, also blue, was wider than necessary to perform its presumed function of emphasizing her body shape. The overall effect was positive, but largely due to the exposure of Rosie's legs rather than the aesthetic properties of the costume. I had switched from riding my new bike to accompanying her on the subway to increase contact time. I reminded myself the deception is temporary, and in support of a surprise, surprises are positive. Rosie had not revealed my birthday weekend excursion to the Smithsonian. I stepped into the bathroom to prevent Rosie interpreting my body language. "I'm running a bit late. I'll get the next train," I said.
"You what?"
"Running late. It's not a problem. I don't have any lectures today." All three statements were technically true, but the first was deceptive. I planned to take the whole day off.
"You okay, Don? This pregnancy thing has thrown you, hasn't it?"
"Only by a few minutes." Rosie had joined me in the bathroom and was examining some component of her face in the mirror.
"I'll wait for you."
"Not necessary. In fact, I'm considering riding my bike to make up time."
"Hey, I want to talk to you. We hardly talked all weekend."
It was true that the weekend had been disrupted and the communication had thus been reduced. I began to formulate a response, but now that I was in deception mode, it was difficult to conduct a normal conversation. Fortunately, Rosie conceded without further input from me.
"All right, but call me for lunch or something."
Rosie kissed me on the cheek, then turned and left our apartment for the last time. Dave arrived in his van 8 minutes later. We needed to move swiftly as he was required at the Cellar in the Sky to take delivery of the English ale. It took 58 minutes to pack the furniture and plants. Then I tackled the bathroom. I was astonished by the number of cosmetic and aromatic chemicals that Rosie owned. It would presumably have been insulting for me to tell her that, beyond the occasional dramatic use of lipstick or perfume, which faded rapidly after application due to absorption, evaporation, or my becoming accustomed to it, they made no observable difference. I was satisfied with Rosie without any modifications. Despite the quantity, the chemicals fitted in a single garbage bag. As Dave and I packed the remaining contents of the apartment into Rosie's suitcases, cardboard boxes, and additional polythene bags, I was amazed by the sheer quantity of stuff we had accumulated since arriving. I remembered a statement Rosie had made prior to leaving Melbourne.
"I'm leaving all the crap behind. I'm hardly bringing anything."
It was true that she had contradicted this statement by bringing 3 suitcases, but her intent was clear. Moving was an opportunity to review possessions. I decided to discard anything not essential to our lives. I recalled some advice I'd read in a magazine waiting for the dentist on the 5th of May, 1996. If you haven't worn it or used it for 6 months, you don't need it. The principle seemed sensible, and I began applying it. Dave accompanied me to the doorman's office to surrender my key. Rosie's would need to be returned later. We were greeted by the superintendent. He was, as usual, unfriendly.
I hope you're not here to complain about anything, Mr. Tillman. I haven't forgotten about talking to the owners, he said.
Unnecessary. We're leaving. I gave him the key.
What? No notice? You gotta give 30 days notice.
You indicated that I was an undesirable tenant who could be replaced tomorrow with a desirable one. It seems like a good outcome for everyone.
If you don't care about a month's rent,
he laughed. That seems unreasonable. If you have a new tenant in the apartment, you'd be receiving double rent for a month.
I don't make the rules, Mr. Tillman. Take it up with the owner if you want.
I was conscious of becoming annoyed. Today was inevitably going to involve a high level of stress, beginning with the abandonment of scheduled Monday activities. It was time to practice my empathy skills. Why was the supervisor consistently so unpleasant? The answer did not require much reflection. He was required to deal with tenants who complained about problems that he was powerless to rectify, due to his low status and the recalcitrance of the company that owned the building. He was constantly dealing with people in conflict. His low status alone put him at increased risk of coronary heart disease due to elevated cortisol. World's worst job. I suddenly felt sorry for him. I apologize for causing you trouble. Can you connect me with the owner, please?
You want to speak with the owner?
Correct.
Good luck.
Incredible. My simple exercise in empathy now had the superintendent on my side, offering his good wishes. He made a call.
I got the tenant in 12-4 with me. He's leaving. Right now, today.
You got it. No notice. And he thinks he should get his deposit back. He laughed and handed me the phone. Dave took it from me.
Let me do this.
Dave's voice changed. The tone was difficult to describe, but it was as if Woody Allen had been cast instead of Marlon Brando in The Godfather.
My friend here got a problem with the legality of the air conditioning system. Might be a safety risk.
There was a pause.
A licensed air conditioning inspector, said Dave. You got self-contained units all over the building and like what's on a toll? We don't act unless we get a complaint, but then we'd be obliged to look at the whole damn building. I guess if my friend's paying the rent for another month, he might just want to do that, make a complaint, which could be very expensive for you. Or maybe you'd like to let him go now, with his security deposit.
There was a longer pause. Dave's face registered disappointment. Perhaps the warts on a toad metaphor had confused the owner. Toads are presumed to cause warts, not to have warts. He handed me the phone.
You done? Said a male voice down the line.
Greetings.
Oh, shit, it's you. You're leaving. I recognized the voice now. It was not the owner. It was the employee I frequently spoke to about problems that the owner was contractually responsible for, but the superintendent considered outside his domain. The stability of temperature, the speed of the internet service, regularity of fire drills, etc. Correct. Actually, until now, I was unaware of the air conditioning compliance problem. It sounds extremely serious. I recommend, forget it. Just drop by and I'll have a check waiting for you. What about the air conditioning? Forget about the air conditioning and we'll write you a lovely reference for your next landlord. We're going to miss you, Professor. In the van, Dave's hands were shaking. Is there a problem?
I need something to eat. I hate doing that stuff. Confrontation, I'm no good at it.
You didn't need to.
Yes, I did. Not just for your rent, I need the practice. People think they can take me down.
George was waiting for us and the beer when we arrived at the cellar in the sky. I'm impressed, he said to Dave. Don tells me he cares so much about the beer that he's going to sleep with it. Not because I care so much about the beer, because it's high-quality accommodation that would otherwise be unused.
In the best location in New York City, and you're getting it for free. No rent, no complaints, said Dave. He was practicing his tough guy voice.
You know, we practice upstairs, said George.
Loud. There's bugger all sound insulation.
So, it's unrentable, said Dave. Incredible. A three-bedroom apartment plus cool room considered unrentable because of an occasional noise problem, easily counteracted with earplugs. Or George could have advertised for deaf tenants.
George shrugged. I'm not allowed to rent it. I bought it so the kids could visit, you know, any time they're in New York and want to see their father. I don't think that's going to be a risk for you.
How often do you practice? I asked.
George laughed. About once a year. Maybe the beer will inspire me.
We were interrupted by the arrival of the beer, six large barrels with stands. There was a minor accident carrying the last of these through the living room, resulting in a spillage which I estimated at 20 litres. By the time Dave obtained cloths and mops, it had soaked into the carpet. Sorry, said George, but no complaints, remember? I've got a hairdryer if you want. While Dave dried the carpet with Rosie's hairdryer, I unpacked the garbage bags. The cellar in the sky had three bathrooms, which was patently excessive. The non-ensuite bathroom was large enough to serve as an office, so I installed my computer and work table there. There was no room for a chair, but the toilet seat was at the correct height. I covered it with a towel for hygiene and comfort. Now I would be able to work all day without ever needing to come out, except for nourishment. I pulled my mind away from the fantasy of permanent isolation. I had practical tasks to complete in a limited time frame. I designated the largest bedroom as Rosie's office, and with Dave's help, moved in the plants and surplus chairs. I selected the smallest and least well-lit bedroom as our sleeping quarters. Sleeping, I explained over Dave's objections, requires minimal space, and light is an impediment. There were still a few square meters of unused floor after we installed the bed. We finished at 6:27 p.m. Rosie seldom left Columbia before 6:30 p.m. to avoid subway crowds and the heat. To maximize the surprise, I delayed communicating our change of accommodation until the last possible moment. A few seconds after I sent the text message, I heard a sound from her handbag, the one she took to work at the Alchemist rather than the larger one she used for university. She'd left her phone at home. It was not the first time and was the predictable result of owning more than one handbag. Dave came back from returning George's hairdryer and offered to intercept her at our former apartment. "While I'm gone, you better get rid of the stink," he said. I'd become accustomed to it, but the beer smell was now mingled with the acrid fumes that the motor in Rosie's hairdryer had produced when it burned out. George's was obviously of a higher quality and had lasted it almost three times as long. I decided that a strong-smelling fish would be appropriate to mask the smell and also solve the dinner problem. At the delicatessen, my phone rang with an unfamiliar number. It was Rosie.
"Don, what's happened? They won't let me in."
"You left your phone at home."
"I know. This is Jerome's phone."
"Jerome? Are you in danger?"
No. He apologized about the washing. He's right here." "What did you say to him?"
She did not allow adequate time to answer.
"What's going on?"
"We've moved. I'll text you the address. I need to ring Dave." I hung up and texted our new location to Jerome's phone. Dave, Rosie, Jerome, Jean, the fish. I was at my limit of multitasking. The smoked mackerel was already in the oven and generating aromas of similar intensity to the stale beer and burned wiring when the doorbell rang. It was Rosie. I released the building entrance lock, and approximately 30 seconds later, she knocked.
"You don't have to knock," I said. "This is our apartment."
I opened the door dramatically to display the large living room. Rosie looked around, then walked straight to the windows and looked out over the balcony. The view. Of course, Rosie was interested in views. I hoped she did not have a problem with looking at New Jersey.
"Oh, my God," she said. "You're kidding me. What's it costing?"
"Zero." I retrieved our list of desirable apartment attributes from my pocket and showed her. It was like the Wife Project questionnaire, which, despite Rosie's criticisms, had indirectly brought us together. Except now every box was ticked. The perfect apartment. It was apparent that Rosie agreed. She opened the doors to the balcony and spent approximately 6 minutes looking across the Hudson before stepping back inside.
"What are you cooking?" she asked. "Is that fish?"
"I've been craving something smoked all day. I thought being pregnant was making me want to smoke again, which is totally weird. But smoked fish is brilliant. You've blackened it and cooked it in beer, right? You read my mind."
She dropped her phone-free handbag on the floor and hugged me. I had not read Rosie's mind, nor created the culinary disaster which it contained. But there was no point in undermining her happiness. She wandered around without any obvious purpose for a while, then started exploring in a more systematic manner. Starting with her bathroom, which seemed an odd choice.
"Don, my cosmetics, all my stuff. How could you do this?
I've made some sort of error?"
"The opposite. It's like everything is exactly where it was, in the same position."
"I took photos. Your system was impossible to understand. I did the same with your clothes."
"You moved everything today?"
"Of course. I planned to do some culling, but I couldn't remember everything you'd worn in the last 6 months. I generally don't notice what you wear, so I had to retain everything."
"This is where you're planning to work," she said,
a few seconds after opening the door to my bathroom office.
"Correct." "Well, I won't be invading your personal space, given I
won't know what you're using it for.
When she discovered the beer room, I explained the arrangement with George. It's like house sitting. Instead of a dog, he has beer, which, unlike a dog, does not require feeding.
I gather it still managed to do the equivalent of pee on the floor.
I'd forgotten the smell. Humans rapidly become accustomed to their environments. I doubted that Rosie's long-term happiness would be significantly decreased if the beer smell remained, nor for that matter would it be increased by the change of apartments. After the most basic physical requirements are satisfied, human happiness is almost independent of wealth. A meaningful job is far more important. One day in the life of Ivan Denisovich laying bricks in Siberia probably generated a higher level of happiness than one day in the life of a retired rock star in a Manhattan penthouse with all the beer he could drink. Work was crucial to sanity, which was probably why George continued to perform on the cruise ship. Rosie was still talking.
You're serious about not paying rent?
Correct.
How would you feel if I gave up the cocktail bar job? It's not the same anymore. It's probably only a matter of time before Wineman fires me anyway.
Incredible. It appeared that our being fired by Wineman was a positive, or at least had a zero impact. An item of bad news that would have detracted from my day's success had been rendered irrelevant. We can both give it up, I said. It would be vastly less enjoyable without you. Rosie hugged me again. I was hugely relieved. I had undertaken a major, risk-prone project, solving multiple problems simultaneously, with complete success. I had cut the Gordian knot. Rosie's only negative reaction was to the use of the smallest room as our bedroom, as predicted by Dave. But then she said,
"You gave me the biggest room for my office, and, of course, we'll need an extra bedroom."
It was good that she had accepted my solution to the gene problem without further discussion. I texted him the good news along with our new address. I served the fish with a Robert Mondavi Reserve Chardonnay, me, and a celery juice, Rosie. I'd not bothered to buy the vacuum pump for the wine. Any surplus could be kept cool in the beer storage room. For the next 8 months, I would be drinking for two. Rosie raised her glass, clinked it with mine, and then, with just a few words, reminded me of the problem, the terrible problem that had been hiding behind all the others.
So, Professor Tillman, how do you feel about being a father?
Chapter 7. My thoughts about being a father had progressed in the following sequence. 1. Prior to my late teens, I assumed that fatherhood would occur as my life proceeded according to the most common pattern. I did not contemplate it in any more detail. 2. At university, I discovered my incompatibility with women and gradually abandoned the idea due to the improbability of finding a partner. 3. I met Rosie and fatherhood was back on my agenda. I was initially concerned that my general oddness would be an embarrassment to any children, but Rosie was encouraging and clearly expected us to reproduce at some point. As the actual creation of children had not been scheduled, I forgot about it. 4. Then everything changed as a result of a critical event. I'd planned to discuss it with Rosie, but had not given it any priority, again because nothing had been scheduled and also because it reflected badly on me. Now, due to lack of planning, a child was almost inevitable, and I had not disclosed important information. The critical event was the bluefin tuna incident. It had occurred only 7 weeks earlier, and the memory of it returned as soon as Rosie raised the topic of fatherhood. We had been invited to Sunday lunch with Isaac and Judy Esler, but Rosie had forgotten that she had scheduled a study group meeting. It made sense for me to proceed alone. Isaac had asked for my recommendation as to venue. My automatic response was to select a restaurant I'd visited several times before, but Rosie had persuaded me to do otherwise.
"You're way better at restaurants than you used to be, and you're a foodie. Pick somewhere interesting and surprise them."
Following substantial research, I selected a new Japanese fusion restaurant in Tribeca and advised Isaac. On arrival, I discovered that Isaac had booked a table for 5, which was slightly annoying. A 3-person conversation involves 3 pairs of human interactions, 3 times as many as a 2-person conversation. With familiar people, the complexity is manageable. But with 5 people, there would be 10 pairs, 4 involving me directly and 6 as an observer. 7 of these would involve unfamiliar people, assuming that Isaac and Judy had not coincidentally invited Dave and Sonia or the Dean of Medicine at Columbia, statistically unlikely in a city the size of New York. Keeping track of the dynamics would be virtually impossible, and the probability of a faux pas would be increased. The scene was set: unfamiliar people, a restaurant I had not visited before,
no Rosie to monitor the situation and provide an early warning. In retrospect, disaster was inevitable. The additional people were a man and a woman who arrived in advance of Isaac and Judy. They joined me at the table where I was drinking a glass of sake and introduced themselves as Seymour, a colleague of Isaac, hence presumably a psychiatrist, and Lydia, who did not specify her profession. Seymour was aged approximately 50 and Lydia approximately 42. I had been trying, with minimal success, to eliminate a habit acquired during the WIFE project of calculating body mass index, based on estimates of height and weight, but in this case it was impossible not to notice. I estimated Seymour's BMI at 30 and Lydia's at 20, primarily due to their difference in height. Seymour was approximately 165 centimeters tall, or more descriptively short, about the same height as Isaac, who is thin, while Lydia's height was approximately 175 centimeters, only 7 centimeters less than mine. They formed a striking counterexample to Jean's assertion that people tend to select partners who resemble them physically. Commenting on the contrast seemed to be a good way to get the conversation started and to introduce an interesting topic on which I was knowledgeable. I was careful to attribute the research to Jean to avoid appearing egotistical. Despite my not using any pejorative words for height and weight, Lydia responded in a manner that appeared cold.
To begin with, Don, we're not a couple. We just met outside the restaurant.
Seymour was more helpful.
Isaac and Judy invited us separately. Judy's always talking about Lydia, so it's great to meet her at last.
I'm in Judy's book club, said Lydia, addressing Seymour rather than me. Judy's always telling us stories about you.
Good ones, I hope, said Seymour.
She says you've improved since your divorce.
People should be forgiven everything they do 3 months either side of a divorce.
On the contrary, said Lydia, that's exactly what they should be judged on.
Lydia's information that they were merely two people who had coincidentally been invited to the same lunch was in line with Jean's theory. It gave me an opportunity to re-enter the conversation. A victory for evolutionary psychology. The theory predicts that you would not be attracted to each other. I observe evidence that is counter to the theory. More detailed examination of the data supports the theory. I was not seriously offering a scientific analysis, but using scientific language for the purpose of amusement. I have considerable experience with the technique, and it usually results in some level of laughter. In this case, it did not. If anything, Lydia's expression became less happy. Seymour, at least, smiled.
I think your hypothesis rests on some invalid assumptions, he said. I got a bit of a thing for tall women.
This seemed like very personal information. If I'd shared what I found physically attractive about Rosie or women in general, I'm sure I would have been judged as inappropriate. But people with better social skills have more leeway to take risks.
Luckily, Seymour continued, or I'd be limiting my options in a big way.
You're searching for a partner, I asked. I recommend the internet. My extraordinary success in finding the perfect partner as a result of random events did not invalidate the use of more structured approaches. At this point, Isaac and Judy arrived, increasing the conversational complexity by a factor of 3.33, but improving my comfort level. If I'd been left alone with Seymour and Lydia for longer, I would probably have made some sort of social error. We exchanged formulaic greetings. Everyone else ordered tea, but I concluded that if I'd made a mistake in drinking sake, it was too late to recover, and ordered a second flask. Then our waiter brought the menu. There was an array of fascinating food, consistent with the research I'd undertaken on the restaurant, and Judy suggested we order one plate each and share. Excellent idea.
Any preferences?
She asked.
Isaac and I don't eat pork, but if someone else wants to order the gyoza, that's fine.
She was obviously being polite, and ordering the gyoza would have made their meals less interesting than the others due to reduced variety. I did not make that mistake. When my turn came, I took advantage of Rosie's absence to try something that would normally have provoked an argument. The bluefin tuna sashimi, please.
Oh, said Lydia. I didn't see that. Don, you might not be aware that bluefin is an endangered species.
I was aware of this fact. Rosie ate only sustainable seafood. In 2010, Greenpeace had added the southern bluefin tuna to its seafood red list, indicating a very high risk of it being sourced from unsustainable fisheries.
I know. However, this one is already dead, and we will only be sharing a single portion among five people. The incremental effect on the world tuna population is likely to be small. In exchange, we have an opportunity to experience a new taste.
I'd never eaten bluefin tuna, and it had a reputation for being superior to the more common yellowfin, which is my favorite food component.
I'm up for it as long as it's definitely dead, said Seymour. I'll skip my rhino horn pills tonight to make up.
My mouth was open to comment on Seymour's extraordinary statement, but Lydia spoke first, giving me time to consider the possibility that Seymour was making a joke.
Well, I'm not up for it, she said. I don't accept the argument that individuals can't make a difference. That's the attitude that's stopping us doing anything about global warming.
Isaac offered a useful if obvious contribution.
Plus the Indians and Chinese and Indonesians wanting to have our standard of living.
Lydia may or may not have agreed, but she was talking to me.
I suppose you don't think about what sort of car you drive or where you shop.
Her supposition was incorrect, as was the implication that I was environmentally irresponsible. I do not own a car. I ride a bike, use public transport, or run. I have relatively few clothes. Under the standardized meal system, only recently abandoned, I had virtually zero waste in food, and I now treated the efficient use of leftovers as a creative challenge. But I consider my contribution to reducing global warming negligible. My position on rectifying the problem seems to be unattractive to many environmentalists. I had no desire to spoil our lunch with unproductive arguments, but Lydia seemed to be already in irrational greeny mode, so, as with the sake, there was no point in holding back. We should be investing more in nuclear power, I said, and finding technological solutions.
Such as, said Lydia,
removing carbon from the atmosphere. Geoengineering. I've been reading about it. Incredibly interesting. Humans are poor at restraint, but good at technology.
Do you know how abhorrent I find that type of thinking? Said Lydia. Do whatever you like and hope that someone will come along and fix it and get rich doing it. Are you going to save the tuna that way too?
Of course. It's highly possible we could genetically engineer the yellowfin tuna to taste like bluefin. Classic example of a technological solution to a problem created by humans. I would volunteer for the tasting panel.
You do whatever you want, but I don't want us as a group to order the tuna.
It is incredible what complex ideas can be conveyed by a human facial expression, although no guide was likely to include it. I believe I was correct in interpreting Isaac's as, "For fuck's sakes, Don, don't order the tuna." When our server arrived, I ordered the scallops with foie gras de canard. Lydia began to stand up, then sat down again.
You're actually not trying to upset me, are you? She said. You're really not. You're just so insensitive you don't know what you're doing.
Correct. It was the easiest to tell the truth, and I was relieved that Lydia did not consider me malicious. I saw no logical reason why a concern about sustainability should be a predictor of what I assumed was an objection to the treatment of farmed poultry. I consider it wrong to stereotype people, but it might have been useful in this situation.
I've met people like you, she said. Professionally.
You're a geneticist.
I'm a social worker.
Lydia, said Judy, this is getting too much like work. I'm going to order for the whole table and we should all start again. I've been dying to hear about Seymour's book. Seymour's writing a book. Tell us about your book, Seymour.
Seymour smiled.
It's about growing meat in laboratories so vegetarians can have a guilt-free burger.
I began to respond to this unexpectedly interesting topic, but Isaac interrupted.
I don't think this is the right time for a joke, Seymour.
Seymour's book is about guilt, but not about burgers. Actually, I do mention lab burgers as an example of how complex these issues are and the way deeply rooted prejudices come into play. We need to be more open to thinking outside the box. That's all Don's been saying. This was essentially correct, but it started Lydia off again.
That's not what I'm complaining about. He's entitled to an opinion. I let the evolutionary psychology stuff go before, even though it's crap. I'm talking about his insensitivity.
We need truth-tellers, said Seymour. We need technical people. If my plane's going down, I want someone like Don at the controls.
I would have assumed he would want an expert pilot rather than a geneticist flying the plane, but I guessed he was attempting to make a point about emotions interfering with rational behavior. I noted it for future use as perhaps less confronting than the story about the crying baby and the gun.
You want some guy with Asperger's flying your plane, said Lydia.
Better than someone who uses words I don't understand, said Seymour.
Judy tried to interrupt, but Lydia and Seymour's argument had acquired a momentum that excluded the rest of us. even though the topic of conversation was me. I had some familiarity with Asperger's syndrome from preparing a lecture 16 months earlier when Jean had been unable to meet the commitment due to a sexual opportunity. Consequently, I had helped to initiate a research project looking for genetic markers for the syndrome in high-achieving individuals. I'd noted some of my own personality traits in the descriptions, but humans consistently over-recognize patterns and draw erroneous conclusions based on them. I had also, at various times, been labeled schizophrenic, bipolar, an OCD sufferer, and a typical Gemini. Although I did not consider Asperger's syndrome a negative, I did not need another label, but it was more interesting to listen than to argue.
"Look who's talking," said Lydia. "If anyone doesn't understand Asperger's, it's psychiatrists. Autism, then. You want Rain Man flying your plane?"
The comparison made no more sense than it did later, when Loudwoman drew it. I certainly would not have wanted Rain Man flying my plane if I owned one, or a plane in which I was a passenger. Lydia must have assumed that she was causing me distress. "Sorry, Don, this isn't personal. I'm not calling you autistic. He is." She pointed to Seymour. "Because he and his buddies don't know the difference between autism and Asperger's. Rain Man and Einstein, it's all the same to them." Seymour had not called me autistic. He had not used any labels, but had described me as honest and technical, essential attributes for a pilot and positive in general. Lydia was attempting to make Seymour look bad for some reason, and the complexities of the three-way interaction between us had now exceeded my ability to interpret them. Seymour addressed me. "Judy tells me you're married. I've got that right?"
"Correct."
"Stop. Enough," said Judy. "Four people, six interactions." Isaac raised his hand and nodded. Seymour apparently interpreted the combination of signals as approval to continue. All five of us were now involved in a conversation with invisible agendas. "You're happy, happily married?" I wasn't sure what Seymour's questioning was about, but I concluded that he was a fundamentally nice person who was trying to support me by demonstrating that at least one person liked me enough to live with me. "Extremely. In touch with your family?"
"Seymour," said Judy.
I answered Seymour's question, which was benign. "My mother phones me every Saturday, Sunday, Australian, Eastern Standard Time. I don't have any children of my own."
"Gainfully employed?"
"I'm an associate professor of genetics at Columbia. I consider that my work has social value in addition to providing an adequate income. I also work in a bar. Mixing comfortably with people in a generally relaxed but sometimes challenging social environment, with an eye on the commercial imperatives, enjoying life." "Yes" seemed to be the most useful answer. "So you're not autistic. That's a professional opinion. The diagnostic criteria required dysfunction, and you're enjoying a good life. Go on enjoying it and stay away from people who think you've got a problem."
"Good," said Judy. "Can we pull some food now and have a pleasant lunch?"
"Screw you," said Lydia. She was talking to Seymour, not Judy. "You need to pull your head out of your diagnostic manual and go into the street. Go visit some real people's homes and see what your airline pilots do." She stood and picked up her bag. "Order whatever you want." She turned to me. "I'm sorry, it's not your fault. You're not going to undo whatever trauma happened in your childhood. But don't let some fat little shrink tell you it doesn't matter, and do me and the world one favor."
I assumed she was going to mention the bluefin tuna again. I was wrong.
"Don't ever have children."
Chapter 8.
"Earth to Dawn, are you still reading me? I asked how you're feeling about becoming a father."
I did not need Rosie's reminder. My reflections on the bluefin tuna incident had been replaced by a struggle to answer her question, and I was not making much progress. I suspected that Claudia's recommended response to difficult personal inquiries, "Why are you asking?" would not work here. It was obvious why Rosie was asking. She wanted to ensure that I was psychologically ready for the most challenging and important task of my life. And the truth was that I'd already been judged, professionally judged, by a social worker accustomed to dealing with family disasters, as unfit. In describing the lunch to Rosie 7 weeks earlier, I focused on matters that would be of immediate interest to her: the restaurant, the food, and Seymour's book about guilt. I did not mention Lydia's assessment of my suitability as a father, since it was only a single, albeit expert, opinion, and of no immediate relevance. My mother had given me a useful rule when I was young: before sharing interesting information that has not been solicited, think carefully about whether it has the potential to cause distress. She had repeated it on a number of occasions, usually after I had shared some interesting information. I was still thinking carefully when the doorbell rang.
Shit, who's that? Said Rosie.
I could predict who it was with a high degree of certainty, taking into account the scheduled arrival time of the Qantas flight from Melbourne via Los Angeles and travel time from JFK. I released the security lock, and Rosie jumped up to open the door. When Gene emerged from the elevator, he was carrying two suitcases and a bunch of flowers, which he immediately gave to Rosie. Even I could see that his arrival had caused a change in the human dynamics. A few moments earlier, I was struggling to find the words to say. Now the problem had been transferred to Rosie. Fortunately, Gene is an expert in social interaction. He moved towards me as if to hug me, then, detecting my body language or remembering our past protocols, shook my hand instead. After releasing it, he hugged Rosie. Gene is my best friend, yet I find hugging him uncomfortable. In fact, I only enjoy close contact with people with whom I have sex, a category containing one person only. Rosie dislikes Gene, yet she manages to hug him for approximately 4 seconds without a break.
I can't tell you how much I appreciate this, said Gene.
I know you're not my biggest fan. He was speaking to Rosie, of course. I have always liked Gene, although this has required forgiveness for some immoral behavior. You've gained weight, I said. We need to schedule some running. I estimated Gene's BMI as 28, 3 points higher than when I'd last seen him 10 months earlier.
How long are you staying? Said Rosie. Has Don told you I'm pregnant?
He has not, said Gene. That's wonderful news. Congratulations.
He used the wonderful news as an excuse to repeat the hug and avoid answering the question about the duration of his visit. Gene looked around.
I really do appreciate this. What a great place. Columbia must pay better than I thought, but I'm interrupting dinner.
Oh, no, said Rosie. We shouldn't have started before you. Have you eaten?
I'm a bit jet-lagged, not sure what time my body thinks it is.
Here, I could help. You should drink alcohol. Remind your body that it's evening. I went to the cool room to collect a bottle of Pinot Noir while Gene began unpacking in what, until now, had been the spare room. Rosie followed me. Rosie stared at the barrels of beer, then looked suddenly ill and dashed out. It was true that the smell was much stronger inside the cool room. I heard the bathroom door slam. Then there was a loud noise, a crash, but not from the bathroom. It was followed by a booming sound at similar volume. It was drumming from upstairs. An electric guitar joined in. When Rosie returned from the bathroom, I had the earplugs ready, but I suspected that her level of satisfaction had dropped. She went to her new study while I fitted my own earplugs and finished my meal. 52 minutes later, the music stopped and I was able to talk with Gene. He was certain that his marriage was over, but it seemed to me that he merely needed to rectify his behavior permanently.
Well, that was the plan, he said. It was the only reasonable plan. Draw up a spreadsheet, two columns. On one side you have Claudia, Carl, Eugenie, stability, accommodation, domestic efficiency, moral integrity, respectability. No more inappropriate conduct complaints, vast advantages. On the other, you have occasional sex with random women. Is it significantly better than sex with Claudia?
Oh, of course not. Not that I've had a chance to compare recently. Can we talk about this later? It's been a long flight, two flights. We can talk tomorrow, every day until we get it resolved.
Don, it's over. I've accepted it. Now, tell me how it feels to be an expectant father.
Oh, I don't have any feelings about it yet. It's too early.
I think I might ask you every day until we get it resolved. You're a bit nervous, aren't you?
How can you tell?
All men are. Worried they'll lose their wives to the baby. Worried they'll never have sex again. Worried they won't cut it.
I'm not average. I expect I will have unique problems. And you'll solve them in your own unique way.
This was an extremely helpful contribution. Problem solving is one of my strengths, but it failed to address the immediate dilemma.
What do I tell Rosie? She wants to know how I feel.
You tell her that you're excited about being a father. Don't burden her with your insecurities. Got any port?
The music started again. I didn't have any port, so substituted Contro, and we sat without talking until Rosie came out to get me.
Gene had fallen asleep in the chair. It was probably more comfortable than sleeping on the floor. It was certainly better than being homeless in New York. In the bedroom, Rosie smiled and kissed me.
So the Gene situation is acceptable, I said.
No, it's not. Nor is the beer smell, which we're going to have to do something about if you don't want me throwing up in the evenings as well as the mornings. And obviously you need to talk to the people upstairs about the noise. I mean, you can't give earplugs to a baby. But the apartment is just stunningly, wonderfully brilliant.
Sufficient to compensate for the problems.
Almost, she smiled.
I looked to the world's most beautiful woman, dressed only in a too large T-shirt, sitting up in my bed, at our bed, waiting for me to say the words that would allow this extraordinary situation to continue. I took a deep breath, expelled the air, then took another deep breath to allow speech. I'm incredibly excited about becoming a father. I was using the word excited in the sense that I would use it to say an electron was excited, activated rather than in a particular emotional state. Hence I was speaking sincerely, which was a good thing, as Rosie would have detected a lie. Rosie flung her arms around me and hugged me for longer than she'd hugged Jean. I was feeling much better. I could allow my intellect to rest and enjoy the experience of being close to Rosie. Jean's advice had been excellent and had, at least for me, justified his presence. I would solve the noise problem and the beer problem and the fatherhood problem in my own way. I woke with a headache, which I attributed to the stress associated with recalling the bluefin tuna incident. My life was becoming more complex. In addition to my duties as professor and spouse, I was now responsible for monitoring Beer, Jean, and potentially Rosie, whom I suspected would continue to be neglectful of her health even during this critical period. And of course, I needed to do some research to prepare myself for fatherhood. There were two possible responses to the increased load. The first was to put in place a more formal schedule to ensure that time was allocated efficiently, taking into account the relative priority of each task and its contribution to critical goals. The second was to embrace chaos. The correct choice was obvious. It was time to initiate the baby project. I suspected Rosie would have a negative reaction to the installation of a whiteboard in the living room. I discovered a brilliant solution. The white tiles on the walls of my new bathroom office were tall and narrow, approximately 30 centimeters high and 10 centimeters wide. They provided a ready-made grid with a surface suitable for a whiteboard marker. On one wall were 19 columns of 7 tiles, interrupted only by the toilet roll holder, which occupied one tile and obscured another, an almost perfect template for a rolling 18-week calendar. Each tile could be divided into 17 horizontal slots to cover waking hours, with the possibility of further vertical subdivision. Rosie was unlikely to see the schedule, given her statement about respecting my personal space. Of course, I could have used a computer spreadsheet or calendar application. But the wall was much bigger than my screen, and filling in my scheduled research meetings, martial arts training, and market jogs for the first 4 weeks induced an unexpected sense of well-being. The morning after Jean's arrival, we travelled together on the subway to Columbia. The journey from our new apartment was much shorter, and I'd rescheduled my departure time accordingly. Rosie had not yet adjusted her daily routine and took an earlier train. I used the time to talk to Jean about his family problem. She rejected you because you cheated on her multiple times after you lied to her about stopping. Therefore, she needs to be convinced that you are no longer a cheat and a liar. Not so loud, Don. I had raised my voice to emphasize these critical points, and people were looking at us, and Jean particularly, with disapproval. A woman stepping off at Penn Station said, "Shame on you!" The woman behind her added, "Pig!" It was useful to have my argument reinforced, but Jean attempted to change the subject. Thought any more about fatherhood? I had not yet included any baby-related activities in my new white-tile schedule, although they had been the original motivation for creating it. It was possible my mind was responding to an unexpected event by activating primitive defense mechanisms and pretending it did not exist. I needed to do two things: acknowledge the upcoming birth by stating it out loud to others, and undertake some actual research. After installing Jean in his office at Columbia, we had coffee with Professor David Borenstein. Rosie joined us in her role as my partner rather than as a medical student. David had been extremely helpful in supporting our visas and relocation. "So what's news with you, Don?" he asked. I was about to give David an update on my investigation of genetic predisposition to cirrhosis of the liver in mice, which was nearing completion, when I remembered my earlier decision to acknowledge my impending fatherhood. "Rosie's pregnant," I said. Everyone was silent. I knew immediately that I had made an error, as Rosie kicked me under the table. It was obviously ineffective. The statement could not be retracted. "Well," said David, "congratulations." Rosie smiled.
Thanks. It's not really public yet, so...
Of course. And with my faculty hat on, I can assure you that you're not the first student to have some disruption to their studies. I'm not planning to let it disrupt my studies. I recognize Rosie's don't fuck with me voice. It seemed inadvisable to you.